welcome to Pete's Percussion Podcast. I'm your host, Pete Zambito, and we're here for episode 140, a special rebroadcast episode in honor of a couple of very important feature articles that appeared in the May 2019 Percussive Notes magazine, the official publication of the Percussive Arts Society. On episode 129, which was released in February of this year, I welcomed previous podcast guests Teddy Hall Jr. and Joe W. Moore III back on to talk about their research on current and past African-American orchestral percussionists. Their research focused on the life and work of six current or recently retired orchestral percussionists as they surveyed their upbringings, path, and the state of the African-American orchestral percussionist. I was not sure when their article was going to be made available, but I told both of them that once the article was available, which occurred earlier this month, I would re-release their interview in its entirety. As an added bonus, I was unaware that accompanying their research in the same issue was Teddy Hall's biographical account of Richard Johnson, the first African-American to hold a percussion professor position, which occurred at Indiana University in the early 1960s. When I had talked to Teddy Hall Jr. on his episode, which posted in January of 2018, he was in the preliminary stages of his research on Richard Johnson, and he talked at length about him and why he was so important. So, I am including the Richard Johnson section of Teddy Hall's episode here now. The combo interview with Teddy and Joe will appear first, then I'll come back on to reintroduce the segment from Teddy Hall's interview about Richard Johnson. These interviews were recorded over Skype in January of 2018 and February of 2019, and they begin right now.
Lay out kind of what the intentions, the ideas for this particular article on African-American orchestra players, percussionists came from, and go ahead and get started.
Joe, you want me to start or you want to start?
Go ahead, Teddy.
Okay. Well, this started last year. I went to the Sphinx Connect conference in Detroit, Michigan, with some faculty members and students from Alabama State. And I met.
And tell me about the conference and then.
Okay. The conference was in Detroit, Michigan. The Sphinx organization was founded to increase diversity and inclusion amongst minorities, in particular African-Americans and Latinos in orchestras and conservatories.
Okay.
And so we were the only HBCU that was represented there and ran into Raynard Carroll just during one of the breaks. And I'm like, wow, Raynard, you know, finally get to meet you, because I studied out of his Timpani book with Mr. Burkhead at Ole Miss, and I've used some of his books. And we were just sitting down talking, and he told me about, you know, who all he knew as an African-American who was playing professionally. And I knew about Tim Adams because I'd met him at PAS before, so forth and so on. And so fast forward Christmas break, Neil Flum, who's assistant athletic marching band director at University of Alabama. He's, he lives in Birmingham. I'm from Birmingham. We met for coffee at the Revelator coffee shop. And I let him see my article on Richard Johnson. He was very impressed. And he said, you know, you should write more about the African-American orchestral experience in percussion, especially in the 21st century. So I said, you know, I'll definitely do that. And so Joe and I had connected at PAS, you know, in November, and we just stayed in touch. And I said, hey, you know, what do you think about co-writing an article? And so I said, these are the people that we know: Mike Crusoe, Raynard Carroll, Douglas Caldwell, Javon Gilliam, Timothy Adams, and Josh Jones. And he was like, yeah, man, that sounds good. And so we decided to come up with five questions that we would email, you know, each participant, which they all agreed and were, you know, adamant about doing. And we also said we would include in the article, in the intro, the predecessors to the modern times, which would be Miss Elaine Jones, who's the first African-American, period, to be hired as a principal percussionist. And then Dr. Marky Sunkett, whom we recently discovered, not only an orchestral player, but taught African-American percussion and music out at Arizona State University, and also served on the board of directors, if I'm not mistaken, with PAS. So we wanted to highlight all of those and discuss, you know, where we currently are in the future of, you know, diversity in the American symphonies from the percussionist perspective.
Joe, anything you want to add on to that?
The cool thing about it is that, you know, we're getting to learn more about these people and what they've done and their history and how we're all connected to that in some way. It's been a eye-opening experience for me. Just learning about all of these guys, more about them, and then also, in addition to that, learning more about them, but then also realizing that there were people that came before us, and that we can kind of look to for inspiration, and then for younger generations to also look to. So I think it's been an eye-opening experience. It's been wonderful to work with Teddy on this. And you know, it's just been awesome.
How much of what you've kind of discovered through the process of talking to all of these individuals, did you feel like you knew? How much is this like completely new? What's kind of place it into what your existing knowledge of these events? Joe, go first, and then we'll come back to Denny.
Yeah, for me, you know, the big thing for me was really learning, because there's so much I didn't know. And I'm actually glad that Teddy involved me with this project, because the institutions I attended, I don't think intentionally didn't talk about these people, but I just didn't come across a lot of them. I knew about James Latimer. Jeff Moore studied with him, but I hadn't talked to Jeff really much about him. And so just learning these things and learning how I have actually been connected in some way to it is been eye opening. And you know, for me, you know, it's been great to hear from the orchestral guys specifically and their experiences. Even today, I was going back over some of their responses and reading through some of their responses, and you know, just being inspired to even maybe consider auditioning and doing that kind of thing myself. Not that I don't like my job; I do like my job. I love my job, but it's just inspiring to see what people are doing, what people, and specifically what people that kind of look like me also are doing, and that's been the most eye-opening thing, and that's been cool. And I think, you know, for me, it's just been, there's stuff I knew, there's a lot that I didn't know, and I'm happy to grow and learn from it all. So yeah, but thanks Teddy for asking me to join him on this. So
it's an honor.
Yeah, anything to add from your perspective, Teddy?
Same question. It's always good to go back and research and know what's going on. Even right here in Montgomery, I play with the Montgomery Symphony Orchestra, and Vantoni Free III, who was the predecessor in the percussion studio here teaching at Alabama State, retired, but he's also one of the charter members of the Montgomery Symphony Orchestra, and he still plays timpani with them. But just talking to him and not only, you know, learning about the history of music department and percussion area here, but also telling me about, you know, how he graduated from Alabama State, went on to Roosevelt University, and started, you know, playing also professionally while being a studio teacher. And we just talked about I told him about my research project, and he was like, that's a great idea, because you're doing something that's hardly ever done. And when you look in the progressive notes, you really don't see a lot of information about these gentlemen that we've mentioned, as well as Miss Elaine Jones. I talked to a lot of people. They didn't know about Miss Elaine Jones, didn't know about Latimer. Dr. Sunkett is familiar, but again, he's not, because unfortunately he's passed. You know, unless you really was at, if you were at Arizona State University or just kind of ran in those circles, you didn't know about him. And definitely Richard Johnson, a jewel, you know. But the recent gentleman that we've, you know, interviewed, they are the trendsetters. And, you know, just reading their stories of how they got, you know, their responses of how they got inspired, how they started, and what they think needs to be done now and so forth and so on. It's very inspiring as a teacher, specifically to talk to other men who are, especially men of color, black men, who understand, you know, the struggle and also are concerned about our future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, how much, because it was only recently that you posted, whether it was UTEDDY or it was through kind of the PAS diversity, diversity alliance, about Elaine Jones, and I had no idea about her. But how much do we know about her, what it took for her to get her position in 1972, I believe?
Well, she had to win an audition, and it's very little information out there on the internet. It's not a lot. It's some people did an interview, and some people posted some things, but the bulk of her information I have in this book, and this book is called Black Women in American Bands and Orchestras. It's by D. Antoinette Handy, and it's the second edition. I know they have a copy of this in the libraries back at home in Birmingham, but this book was here. It's here on the campus of Alabama State University's library. And I always have a library just looking for extra materials to use in class or just to see what needs to be updated, you know, so forth and so on. And I came across that. And I said, well, let me look, and voila.
Yeah.
There she was, and gave a full, you know, depiction of her and everything in history, and talking about, you know, being from Barbados and what she had to do to accomplish. So, interesting story, interesting background, but again, you know, not much published beyond, you know, what I just mentioned.
Yeah. Is she still around?
To my knowledge, I have not talked to anyone or seen anything on the internet that says that she's passed or not. So I don't know. I'm hoping that she is, because I definitely would like to, you know, if we could contact her. But on that, I'm not for certain.
Yeah. Looking at you listed all the folks that are part of that are part of your essay or your research project. What's the, have there been many other women of color that have had some of these positions?
Not to our knowledge. I mean, of course, it's not common to see a female percussionist outside of classical music playing, but to my knowledge, we have not come across, you know, anyone else.
I've had both of you on the show, and I know, but I'm not remembering if this came up. But how much, when you were both coming up, did you think about orchestral playing, just generally? Teddy, we'll start with you on this end.
It crossed my mind. It didn't stay with me, because my teacher at Florida A&M, Dr. Sheila James, wanted to be an orchestral player, but he just, you know, he still played with the Big Ben Orchestra in the Tallahassee Community Orchestra. And I would play along with him, just getting that experience. When I got to Ole Miss and studied with Burkhead, and he introduced me to John Elaine and so forth, we talked about orchestral repertoire, and I was a timpanist with the University Orchestra and played with the Chorus Symphony and another orchestra in Mississippi that Mr. Burkhead got me connected with. Mm-hmm. But it just never dawned on me that you can actually do this as a career. And or as the, to be the, quite honest.
Yeah, or right. as a primary.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Primary
career. As your primary. And to be honest, that's a good question, because just even thinking about trying to take an audition, mm-hmm. that's a whole nother mindset. And so
right.
at that time, it just never really registered, you know, why don't you consider this? I was just always like, well, I'll just teach. And I think that's a lot of times we just either look at, well, we'll gig, you know, playing drum set, or we'll teach. And it's not, well, you know, that's just not like something that just pops up like, man, I can make a major career or primary position doing this.
Yeah. Joe?
Yeah, for me, starting at Central Florida, it was the program there is more of a well-rounded program. So we touched marching percussion, orchestral concert percussion, world percussion, all those things. I studied with Kirk Gay for the orchestral stuff.
Yeah.
And he went to the Cleveland Institute of Music and everything. But I was into it, but I wasn't into it as like a possible career path. I think once I became about a junior, senior, I decided that I wanted to teach, at the college level. And then I kind of set my sights on that. When I was in graduate school at South Carolina, I played only in the orchestra. I didn't play in the wind ensemble at all. I played, in the orchestra, mostly timpani and then percussion parts. But I was, as a grad student, I was the principal player in the orchestra for my 2 years at South Carolina. And then at LSU, that's when I kind of got more into contemporary percussion literature and performance and things like that. So I and obviously the composition thing was always a big deal for me from my undergrad through my doctorate. So I never really kind of focused myself into that orchestral realm. Not that I couldn't do it, but just it never really dawned on me like, okay, I could be an orchestral player and I could do that if I wanted to do it. I do remember Scott Herring though saying that to me once, that, you know, you could play in an orchestra if you want to do that. And I was like, I don't know if I want to do that.
Right.
But that's really about, that's kind of how it all went for me. Yeah. But now reading all of this and learning about these guys, it's like, man, what a career path that could be, you know,
sure.
You know, and being inspired by that. So that's, it's pretty awesome.
Yeah. One of the tricky things with doing this right now is that this is the, as far as I can tell, the article is still kind of in process, and it sounds like, you know, you're putting together, right? Am I yeah. right? Like it's still being a,
yes.
like it's getting towards the final product. Right. So we don't want to step on too much information that would be in there. That's not the point here. But I do want to ask about how much, when you, for the, all the folks that you talked to, how much resources came into, and I mean resources in terms of what it takes to actually audition, came up as part of, as something that was a problem, that was an issue.
To be honest, really no one mentioned having any type of financial difficulty or setback. I can say, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, Douglas Caldwell just received a some type of grant through the Sphinx.
That's right. Yeah.
To I believe either to go around and help people who do want to audition, or to support, you know, things along that line. But yeah, to my knowledge, nobody said, none of the gentlemen that we interviewed said that they had any type of financial difficulty. And that's not to say that they didn't. That just sure. was never disclosed.
I think some of the if you and I'm trying to gauge where you wanted to go with this, sure. Pete, but if the if there was difficulty, I think more of it was along the lines of just being inspired by other people of color, other percussionists of color. A lot of them mentioned, and I don't want to get into too many details until the article comes out, but a lot of them mentioned seeing someone else or having an experience seeing another player and or also learning from a teacher that kind of inspired them to do it, and even their parents just kind of pushing supporting them and pushing them to do it. So I think more of it was about that, if there is enough support and then also people to look to for guidance.
Yeah. Did the, particularly the kind of the older generation of players that you talked to, did they know about each other? I mean, were they in contact at, you know, while they were the kind of the primes of their performing careers? Or was this kind of like they were all operating in kind of like their own area? And not necessarily as aware of all the other performers that were doing it at the same time.
I would say no, they did know about it. That's not the case. They did know about each other, because the older out of this group, Mike Crusoe, Raynard, and Douglas Carwell and Tim Adams would be your senior orchestral players, and Javon and Josh would be more of the younger, but they all, the seniors did know about each other. And I don't mean that in a derogatory way. Just, you know, having experience, but they did know about each other. And I think this probably was the first time that we kind of all created this group to learn. And, as far as we can tell, which I don't think they would disagree, everybody's embracing each other's and learning. And even in their comments, you know, Javon mentioned he was inspired by Tim Adams' swagger and just how cool he is. And he's very laid back.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, Raynard's has touched a lot of people just through his publications and his writings.
Right.
I mean, who doesn't own one of his orchestral rep books? So I think it just kind of goes hand in hand.
How much of this does it seem like is what schools, you know, like in terms of conservatories and things like that, the professionals you're talking about, how much of that is a factor versus, you know, those that went to state schools that don't have the same kind of name? Like, how much of that was that a factor in what was going on?
Well, I'll say from what I from the information we gathered and from looking at the information, I think it was a mixture.
Okay.
You know, of conservatory and, you know, non-conservatory type schools. I will say that, and it's good that you mentioned that. Your environment does make a difference.
Sure.
Who you study with makes a difference. That's why the Sphinx organization exists, for the primary reason of trying to diversify the pipeline from the classroom to the conservatory, to the orchestral field. The unfortunate thing that I will say is that a lot of times conservatories or non-conservatories may have more resources than the HBCUs. And if we're just being honest about the, you know, where the students are. Prime example, we were the only ones at the Alabama State University was the only ones at the Sphinx Connect organization.
Right.
And I said, man, you know, all of our school, and that's not that they have exclusively not invited other schools or not wanted to. But again, as Joe said, and as you said, you have to see it to be it.
Sure.
And if you're not exposed to that, then you don't ever, it never registers in your mind that I can actually see myself on stage doing this. Another thing is you have to have orchestras or organizations that are willing to partner with schools. Prime example, with the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra, they have the talent development program where they take minorities specifically and encourage them to participate and also serve as a pipeline.
Yeah.
They have the Atlanta Music Project. I've worked with them. They're formed after the El Sistema model. But what they do is they take the youth and after school and they give them, you know, private lessons, ensemble experience as a way of a not necessarily a community service, but another outlet of music education in the city.
Yeah.
And that's the only way you're going to be able to change it because, again, every university doesn't have a university orchestra. They may have a strings program. Mm-hmm. They may not have a university orchestra. So, again, if you have a student that is not knowledgeable or hasn't been exposed to that, then they will think, well, maybe I could do this. So, you know, it was a mixture of both for the the people we interviewed, and even with, I think with Miss Elaine Jones, I want to say that she went to conservatory, non-conservatory. Just going off the top of my head from reading.
Yeah.
So, but it does. I believe where you go and who you study with, it does matter.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean the influence.
Of course. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think Teddy and I were kind of talking about this the other day, is trying to make sure that we stay connected to the HBCU schools because of that exposure, and making sure that they get kind of the access to see, or those students get the access to see people of color just like them that are making a career in percussion and in music. So.
Yeah. Yeah, and Joe, you're relatively close to places like Texas Southern and Prairie View, and have you
still ways away? But yeah,
what's that?
Still a ways away.
Oh, I know it's not. I said relatively. I mean, we're Texas relative. I mean, yeah, yeah. Sorry, that was understood. I'm sorry. I mean, like, well. Well, Joe, on that, a little bit on that note, have you been able to get to some of the, just like kind of with like some of your touring stuff that you've done?
Have you been able to
get to some of these schools?
I have not as of right now.
Okay.
When I was a master's student at South Carolina, I was able to work with some students, at Benedict College
in Columbia. Yeah.
And I had some students. I taught at a high school, Richland Northeast High School, in South Carolina. And I had a lot of students who would end up going to Benedict College. So I would work with a lot of those students and kind of I got to know that program a little bit. And then also South Carolina State University. I went through an interview process for that position when I finished my master's. Unfortunately, I didn't get the position, but that's as much as I had been involved in. But talking with Teddy and doing this project makes me want to be more and more involved and doing that kind of a thing. And so we're working on some things to try and do, hopefully in the next few years or so, put some things together to kind of get to some of these schools and visit and make sure that we are, being an inspiration to the younger generations of percussionists that are coming from the HBCU schools.
Yeah, definitely.
And another thing.
Go ahead.
I didn't mean to cut.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Since you asked this question, just another major intent behind this article is also increasing diversity when it comes to hiring African Americans in percussion departments at non-HBCU universities or even conservatories.
Yeah.
Because one of the other concerns is when you go to conservatories, non-conservatories, universities that are not HBCU will not see a lot of African Americans in the percussion studio.
Yeah.
And for that matter.
Teddy, or they get, you know, they might be part of the, if there's like a diversity initiative, that's, it's going to be like in that pipeline of a hire or of a look, I would say, that happens. Yeah.
And so that was one of the things we touched on that topic, or that question rather, in this interview, because right now there are not a lot of African American men or African Americans, period, that are on the music faculty at universities that are non-HBCUs as head percussion programs.
Yeah.
And that is, again, that's a concern because you have Black students that, you know, they may want to go to an HBCU or they may want to go to a non-HBCU or conservatory, but representation matters.
Right.
And again, if you don't have the mindset or see that you can, you know, go to one of these programs or elite programs, if you want to say that, or exclusive.
Yeah, yeah.
Because as we know, the audition process is very stringent. With a lot of percussion programs across the country, as well as conservatories.
Yeah.
And if you're not prepared to get in, whether you're coming from high school to undergrad or going from undergrad at an HBCU to a non-HBCU or conservatory, it can be intimidating.
Yeah.
And I believe that's part of the reason why we don't always have a lot of students that go on, get advanced degrees or position themselves to even be considered or know how to, you know, market their skill sets and, you know, get these kind of opportunities.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I want to ask about the Sphinx organization, because you said when, because you've mentioned a number of times that you were the only HBCU, is that conference or session that you attended, is that always in the north? Because that would be, I know that would be, because travel, most of the HBCUs are in the south.
It is in Detroit. They actually partnered with the Detroit Symphony.
Okay.
But the beautiful thing, now this is the other caveat to that, they offer scholarship assistance. Mm-hmm. So we were able to go, we applied for scholarships. Well, it's available to everyone.
Yeah.
But, since we knew about it, you know, we decided, well, we'll apply for it. And fortunately, everyone was accepted. And all you have to do is make the deadline, meet the criteria, and, you know, chances are that you'll be accepted. But again, I just don't think it was common knowledge across the board for all the HBCUs. Not that Sphinx was saying no. Because if you go on their website right now, it's a lot of positive things that they're doing in the community and for minorities, period, because that's their vision. They, you know, started out with strings and voice and expand. They're starting to expand more, not just even with the competition, but just with the type of people that they're trying to attract. Mm-hmm. And again, I definitely think that what they're doing is admirable, because if you go across the country, you know, how many orchestras actually are partnering with an HBCU, with a, you know, non-conservatory type institution, with the purpose of attracting, you know, more instrumentalists of color.
Right. Yeah. Well, and some of that gets to the not only the representation, but the support, like the combination of the two.
Right. That's true.
And I'm glad, and I'm also really happy you both brought up the support that was not necessarily financial, but was either familial or just representational as a measure.
Yes.
The efforts of a group like Sphinx, of other partnerships that orchestras are trying to do, Is it new enough that maybe we haven't seen the full efforts of it? Like we haven't, like the generation hasn't come through yet, or do we have any type of data about how it's done?
That's a good question. I would say that it's not so new. The data is out there because they're very transparent on their website, and even at the conference when they give out the program. But you know, they have, you know, opening session, closing session, and they're very transparent about what's being done, where resources are being spent. And if you look at all the fellowships that are available, they do have a lot of fellowships for people to apply for or audition for to work, you know, with orchestras. For example, Josh Jones, before he won the audition with Calgary Philharmonic, I believe he was going to either have a fellowship with the Detroit Symphony or another symphony, but he had to, you know, decline it because he had just won that audition.
Right.
So it's out there, and just to say that it's not public knowledge would not be fair because it is there. I just think that it may not be amongst winds and percussion just so popular right now as we hear. Because when you think about the orchestra, you're always hearing more about, you know, strings.
Sure, yeah.
But when you, you know, wind instruments and percussion instruments, we may typically be more involved with, you know, band programs or especially percussion, DCI, WGI,
yeah,
other types of avenues, but it definitely exists.
Sure. I know this is slightly outside the purview, but how much information have you gathered about how diverse orchestras and particularly in the for African Americans just all, across all instruments? Like, what do we have an idea of numbers for that, or are they at a point of stasis? Have they gotten higher? Do you know where any of that is?
To be honest, I don't. There have been some surveys that they've done, but just going off the top of my head, I can say that they're not. The numbers are not that great.
Sure. Yeah.
You may have maybe per instrument, maybe one, two, and if you're talking about total orchestra, the percentage of there being more than five African Americans is very slim.
Yeah,
if we're talking about just total orchestra players,
mm-hmm.
So it's not. There's some work needed.
Oh sure,
and
yeah.
The support out there for the symphony orchestras has been kind of up and down, and a lot of symphonies I know have been going through some financial challenges, and then they've been able to bounce back and overcome.
Mm-hmm.
But just in general, even before all that, it's a rarity to see a lot of African Americans in a major symphony orchestra, let alone percussion, but just, you know, in that orchestra period, the percentage is very low.
There are a couple of orchestras that are kind of solely African American. Like, isn't there one in Houston? Maybe I'm misremembering. I feel like I've heard.
I can't think of the name of it. I believe it is. I know it's one in Atlanta Orchestra, NOR. That's really African American. I do believe there is one in Houston. You also have chamber groups like the String Queens,
okay,
Black Violin,
mm-hmm.
And I think there's some others out there. I just can't, but I know those two in particular. But there are some that are, you know, strictly all African. All African American orchestras.
Okay.
They do. There are a few that are existing. I just can't. The name escapes me right now.
Sure.
But they are out there.
Is there anything that I haven't asked you, or that you haven't talked about that seems like we should bring up?
The main thing, again, just the inspiration for seeing this is just to bring highlight these gentlemen and what they've done, but also to bring awareness from the percussion aspect in the 21st century, what's going on and where the need is. Because one thing with percussion is ever so evolving. And we're constantly always pushing the envelope, whether it's a contemporary ensemble, marching, drum set, world, and, you know, orchestra. We both, Joe and I, are on committees. We attend PASIC. But again, I think this is an issue. Well, I won't say issue, but a topic that has not really been dealt with or researched. And I'm thankful that Raynard exposed me to other people, because, like I said, out of Tim Adams, Javon Gilliam, and just recently found out connected with Josh Jones.
Yeah.
And himself, I didn't know about Mike Crusoe or Elaine Jones or Doug Carwell until we just actually sat down and started talking.
Yeah.
And then for Neil Flum, just, you know, it's amazing. Conversations, all it takes is a conversation.
Yeah.
We're just sitting down talking, and he, being impressed with the article, he said, well, why don't you write more about it? He said, I haven't read anything in percussive notes specifically on this topic. And it is something. And then just talking about the contributions of African Americans, particularly during Black History Month,
yeah,
we always highlight a lot of the more recent people. But when we delve into the orchestral realm and start looking at teachers and who influenced who, that's really where we started, you know, treading some ground and finding out some interesting things.
Got it. One of the things you said in that Teddy did made me think of something to ask Joe was how much are you asked to be on, if there's like any diversity committee or anything like that, are you just like automatically get placed on that, Joe?
Actually, I haven't actually been in my time here. I haven't actually been on a search committee at all. I've done the training and everything, but I just haven't been asked, which I guess, I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but, to your question, regarding that, one thing I did want to add and kind of continue what Teddy was talking about there is, you know, highlighting what these, teachers have done, you know, the cool thing for me, and I'll kind of go into this just a little bit, was when the Diversity Alliance posted the information about Jim Latimer, James Latimer, and seeing that and knowing that Jeff Moore had studied with him, but then finding out that he had worked with Richard Johnson at IU. I mean, that for me, that's really eye opening and inspiring. To know that that's part of my percussion family tree sort of history. So learning, I think access and then also awareness, like what Teddy was talking about, and the inspiration that all of these guys have had on the percussion field.
Just talking to these gentlemen and just understanding, just asking Renard Carroll, you know, what specifically should my students be doing? Because one thing I can say this, if a student is not given a firm foundation, and then they try to go into a more competitive environment or stringent environment, it's like they'll feel overwhelmed or lost. Mm-hmm. And he just said, well, one of the best things that he said was pick the method books or a solo lick that is going to cater to their individual needs. Because everything, you know, even with teaching, we all know, is not a one-size-fits-all kind of a deal.
Right.
Some students need more, you know, they may need more of this, they may not need more of that. But just talking to them from percussion, you know, from the orchestral side, and just saying, well, you know, what were some of the things that helped you? You know, Josh Jones was big on developing dexterity by Mitchell Peters and Guy LaFleur. Just recently, the Joe Thompson solos, he also told me, doing a lot of green and playing some boxer. But just some of the things. And then Tim Adams, I said, Tim, man, your swag on Tiffany's is just so cool, and just the way you approach it. Mm-hmm. And I told him, I said, definitely, since he's so close, I said, I want to take a lesson with you. And he said, sure, you know, we'll just work it out where I can drive over there. Because he said he wouldn't mind coming, you know, to do a clinic here at Alabama State. And I just, man, it's just so cool. But to just know that people are accessible like that.
Right.
And that's another great thing. Because all of these guys, gentlemen, excuse me, I like to say guys, all of them are busy. But I can tell you from day one, when we connected on Facebook or email, nobody would say, oh, man, I don't have time to do that. They have made the time.
Yeah.
They have really poured their heart and soul. Whatever Joe and I asked them to do, they made the time to do it right away. And they are just as excited about this as we are. Regret that we couldn't have them all on the podcast right here, but I do understand about the technicalities and things. But
sure. It's
really about them, even though we're writing it and doing it. But it's really to highlight them, their contributions, and their thoughts, you know, as to what needs to happen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. On a kind of a more global, and again, I this will probably just require more of a I don't know that there's going to be a specific data about this, but how much from the talking to all these professionals, how much does these orchestras that they're working with think about any of these issues? Do they think about it? Is this something that's a priority for them in any kind of urgent, you know, way, we'll say?
That's a good question. I will say we didn't ask, and I'm sure if we went back and asked that question, they probably would all give an answer. But I will say that's why Sphinx exists, because it is a problem. We can all agree that diversity and inclusion has been pushed now more so than it ever has been in the past.
Yeah, and I agree, certainly, but is that the only orchestra that is, how, is, are they the only ones that are, like, the that active about it? That, you know, that's kind of the...
And to be honest, Pete, I would have to say yes.
Okay, yeah.
Now, I could say Atlanta Symphony Orchestra, because of what they do with the talent development pool in that regard.
Yeah.
They are adamant. But if you just want to, you know, be frank about it, I don't hear about many other orchestras that are, what's a good word, very aggressive in terms of making sure that that's, you know, that's a thing that needs to change, or something we need to really do something more, be more intentional about doing it.
Right.
Because if it was, you know, and that's one thing. Well, I will say this. We did touch on that in the article, mm-hmm. because what all of the gentlemen said was, it's one thing to say that you're doing diversity and inclusion, but it's another thing to actually put programs into place and actually do it in real time.
Right.
You know, put some feet to the vision.
Yes.
Because we hear about, oh, we're going to do this. Well, let's actually see some more things being done. Right. And if you're really intentional about doing it, you have to have those tough conversations.
Yeah.
And I think it does start with asking, why don't we see more African-American percussionists in our studio? Why don't we see them? Why don't we see more auditioning? Because we know they have blind auditions, mock auditions. I mean, we can trace it even to Allstate auditions at a lot of high schools. Mm-hmm. In particular, I can say, just from even judging percussion Allstate auditions, I don't always see a lot of African Americans auditioning. And some of them, you know, I'm not going to say the band director doesn't encourage them, because it's not like, I know the directors are not saying, well, you try out, you don't try out.
Right.
They always put it before students.
Right.
But again, if you don't feel that you have a chance as a person of color of being selected, and you're not seeing yourself beyond that, you gotta renew your mind, but you also gotta get over that mindset that I can And the only way that you do that, you have exposure. Yep. You have people reaching out. When I grew up, we went to children's concerts with the orchestra. Mm-hmm. Now, some still do, and that was exposure right there. But if I'll be honest, I don't remember seeing a lot of blacks mm-hmm. in the Alabama Symphony when we went.
Yeah.
I just don't.
Yeah.
And so I think there is room to be for more to be done, but is it a concerted effort where it's just at the forefront? I don't believe so.
Yeah. Yeah, Joe, have you seen that when you've seen ensemble stuff or stuff you've judged? Does that gel with the kind of stuff you're seeing?
Yeah, well, the area I live in, the demographic is primarily first generation Mexican American students, and the high schools. So when I'm judging solo and ensemble, those are the types of students that I'm seeing primarily down here. I was thinking about some of the stuff that Teddy was saying there, and you know, he talked about going to concerts and things when he was coming up. One of the things I think I was fortunate that kind of got me on this path too was is my band director at my high school is Jay Boulder, mm-hmm. and my assistant band director at the time was Charles Lewis Bryant.
Yeah. Yeah, we talked about it because I went to school with him.
And so I was fortunate, and they're both African American, and I was fortunate to to see those guys, and they're both percussionists too.
Yeah.
When I was coming up in high school, so they encouraged me to do the Allstate thing and that kind of thing, but it's not that way everywhere. And you know, so the more we can reach people and bring attention to all of this, I think the better.
And I know you know, as Teddy was saying about the way that you have to, that some students need more, like the kind of the mark of a good teacher, a lot of it is realizing that some students need more push. Just and like knowing that that's how they have to be interacted with to get to that next level, and the, you know, that sometimes the agency needs to be in the teacher to set all that up, because sometimes students just, they don't know, or as Teddy perfectly mm-hmm. stated, they don't see that this is going to be something that they're going to be successful at.
All right. That's right. And it just has to, be, across the board. I know that PAS is they have the Diversity Alliance committee and initiative, and there are more things to come. Mm-hmm. But again, PAS does not govern higher ed.
Right.
I think that at higher ed, there has to be an awareness that we need to get more African Americans, specifically outside of HBCUs and conservatories, and non-HBCU universities. We need to hire more African-American in our applied faculty and make provisions. Even if that means that we'll hire you on the contingency that you go back and finish your doctorate or whatever you need to do, but we want you here to attract a bigger pool of students and to diversify the ratio of students in the studio, because let's face it, we have, you know, Asians are coming over studying, we have Latinos, but if you go around the country right now and peruse or survey some of these studios at non-HBCUs, you may only find no more than 2 to 3 mm-hmm. African American students at the undergrad and grad level. Maybe 5, but that's a big maybe.
Yeah.
And part of that reason is because if you don't feel welcome or you don't establish those relationships, it's not going to happen. And all of these gentlemen, you know, they went to various universities and conservatories, and they were, you know, there were not a lot of them present when they were coming through. But they had the inspiration to just keep going. And now that they have made it, they give back, and they're, you know, they're adamant about seeing changes. But and that's another good thing that Joe and I both discovered. They're not untouchable. They're not on this big pedestal or plateau that, you know, they're not. They're very accessible. You ask them, and they're willing to help.
Yeah. Well, and you know, even thinking back to when a lot of the that you know kind of first generation of players, they knew like they were really by themselves. Like I mean, they didn't have they couldn't connect over Skype to see. You know, they were they were really like, oh, I have to, I don't have a, like, I really am alone in a lot of cases. Final thought to kind of sew this up.
The big thing for me, I think, is just trying or is to continue to be active in learning more about them, and also learning more about or and also educating more people about these guys and about the issues, not really, I guess about the issues that, that we're seeing or the trends that we're seeing in the orchestral world as far as the number of African-American players in the orchestras, and then also attending state universities and conservatories. My biggest thing is to make sure, I guess, that we're educating people about these guys, and then also that some more positive initiatives or projects come out of this particular project that Teddy and I are doing that enhance and increase or the numbers of African Americans in orchestral settings, in state universities, and also in conservatories. But then also, whilst also staying connected to the HBCU schools, and making sure that all of the students, wherever they are, we're reaching them, and giving them access.
Just thankful for your friendship and opportunity to do this. And one thing I do want to highlight is Joe's. He didn't mention this much, but I want to take the time to do it. Joe, as well as my colleague who was here before me, a classmate from grad school at the University of Alabama, Greg Jackson, are both prolific composers in their own right. And that's one thing that we are seeing arise is that students are interested in composing. Joe did a phenomenal session at PASIC last year.
Yeah, it's great.
On getting involved in composition, and it just inspired me. So it literally moved me to tears to see him up there just breaking it down and talking about it in a way that was not intimidating, that just made it feel like even a baby could do it. And just to see him perform.
Joe practiced, by the way. Joe did practice on his child. So he there was a he had an audience. He was who was ready. So
just to see him and his partner in crime, I like to call him Oliver Malena.
Yeah.
He's a good brother. I mean,
yeah.
Just to you know, we all connected on Facebook, but to meet those guys in person, I mean, we just had a good time laughing and talking. But I was inspired, and I mentioned that because, again, when you see one of your own doing it, I celebrate those.
Yeah.
Because that's not the rarity. That's not the norm. And that's why we're doing things like this, to try to say, hey, this is possible, you know, even in 2019. Because believe it or not, you still have some students that don't feel that they can you know, accomplish or achieve these things.
Yeah.
So we're very, you know, I'm very appreciative of collaborating with Joe on this article, but I definitely would be remiss if we didn't mention something about his compositional skill sets and his compositions, his 1 year for snare drum writing for every day of the year last year. Josh Jones has his spatial studies book that's out. Tim Adams has some products that are out. Mm-hmm. And Raynard Carroll, I mean, what can you say? Who doesn't know about his stuff? So it's not just about, you know, just interviewing for the sake of interviewing or researching, but just looking at how people have turned over things that are resources and that are accessible. But yeah, just thank you for being able to have this interview.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, Pete. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And thanks, Teddy, for those kind words, man. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
All right. And here is the Richard Johnson portion of Teddy Hall Jr.'s episode from January of 2018, beginning right now.
Tell me about Richard Johnson and how important he is and why we need to know about him.
The question came up in the Facebook subgroup that I'm a part of about someone asked who was the first percussion teacher at Indiana University. And a couple of people come in and said George Gaber. And then you had another person to comment and mention the fact that it was Richard Davis Johnson. And the reason I knew about him was because when Jenny Lee Lane came to do a clinic at Ole Miss, and I met him for the first time, we were just talking about African-Americans in percussion. And so I asked him, was he the first African-American percussion professor? And he said, no, you know, there were people who were before me, and he mentioned his name. But the thing was, he said he's never really been given credit for starting the percussion program. So he gave me some list of people to contact, and I reached out to one of them whose name is James Latimer. James Latimer taught my teacher at Florida A&M University because I attended there before transferring to UAB. Mm-hmm. And his name was Cheryl James, and he was a student of James Latimer. James Latimer was a student of Richard Johnson. And along with James Latimer, I also interviewed Ed Hartman, Jim Rinier, Richard O'Donnell, and we'll be also interviewing John Tafoya as well. But Richard Johnson was a student at Indiana University, and he was an undergrad assistant from 1948 to 1950, and he was hired in 1951 as a percussion instructor at the school, with the charge of starting the percussion program, percussion courses, and percussion ensemble. And he was, I don't want to say this, he was just really a hidden figure in the development of that program. He was from New Jersey, was a member of the Tuskegee Airmen, I didn't know this, serving in the military. He, like I said, he graduated from Indiana University in 1950. He spent the summers of 1948 and 49 studying with Saul Goodman. He was a timpanist in the New York Philharmonic. Well, Saul Goodman was a timpanist with the New York Philharmonic Orchestra and also at Juilliard. And so Richard Johnson studied there, and he also studied over in Paris as well. But his timpani playing was what was very attractive as a student, and it was refined under Saul Goodman. But like I said, he was there, started the program, and once George Gaber was hired, he was kind of pushed to the back, in the background. And as a person of color at that time, he just, according to James Latimer, lived a very frustrated and isolated life.
While still working at Indiana.
Right, right.
What year did Gaber get there?
I want to say, just kind of going off the top of my head without looking at my notes, it may be around 1960.
Oh, so a decade
of
teaching there before Gaber gets there.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Got it. What, I mean, as far as you know at this point, why has he been, is it just like a racism thing, or is it something like, why has he been relegated?
You know, just from talking to James Latimer and the others, it was because of race. At that time, just doing some research, he was brought in and he started the program, but what Latimer told me, he came up through the ranks and he never had the professional playing experiences that Gaber had because of his color. So he knew that. And because of that, he focused on teaching and being there for the students. Mm. Well, Gaber had been playing with professional orchestras and making a reputation for himself. So that was attractive. He was hired and promoted over Richard Johnson.
Oh.
But even so, both of them still had, you know, percussion ensembles going on. But as I said earlier, based upon the research and the interviews, he was just always isolated and pushed back to the background. And outside of Indiana University, no mention has been made of his contributions in the world of percussion, because I did a lot of research because of the Indiana University archives. That information was submitted to me, and then just calling various students of his. Mm-hmm. James Latimer was a student of his from 1952 until 1956. And so he was one of his first students. And then after that, the others who I mentioned. But like I said, Latimer had a close relationship with him. And he said he just often complained about having to deal with isolation, and especially living up in Bloomington.
Yeah.
He couldn't even go and get a haircut from reading one of the documents because of his color. Mm-hmm. And a cross was burned in his home by the Ku Klux Klan. Mm-hmm. And so he stayed in the student motel, you know, on campus. But
that's where he lived?
Yes.
The whole time?
Yes.
Oh my gosh. Oh. So that's awful for so many reasons. I mean, I'm just thinking about having to be around students the whole time.
Yeah.
As well as
right,
not having,
right.
I mean, the other parts, but.
Right. Well, he was married, mm-hmm. did have, you know, children. But like I said, just looking at the documents, he lived in the campus hotel. And also, one important thing that to mention, because it was, I hate to say taboo, but also against, you know, student regulation of today's students, he just spent most of his time helping the students and lived a very lonely, isolated life.
Yeah.
And just focused on his teaching. But from interviewing everybody, they were saying that he was a warm person, impeccable as a timpanist, loved opera, loved baseball, and was just concerned about the students and the growth. But unfortunately, you know, being post-World War II, because he's classically trained and not a jazz musician, you know, you hear of Max Roach and others at the time, but being a black man as a classically trained percussionist, that was just unheard of.
Yeah.
And also teaching at a predominantly white institution at that time. So right. It just really inspires me to know that although he endured such, you know, conditions and circumstances at the time, that he still did what he needed to do to inspire and reach out to others. The unfortunate thing is that he committed suicide in 1983 and is very sad and mysterious as to what led to that.
Yeah. Because he starts there, what is he, 22, 23?
30. When he's, when 30. He was about 30 years old when he started teaching.
Okay. So he has all this experience and all of these, he has the Juilliard, he has the Paris, he's got all this experience. He starts. He gets the degree at Indiana. He said 1950,
right.
And then the next year is the percussion instructor,
right. Uh huh. 1951.
Yeah.
September 1951.
Suddenly he had enough. I mean, so there's very little to know about the, like, the last bit. Is that part of what you're still trying to figure out?
as far as his last 10
his last few years or so, or
right? Yes, I'm still still gathering information on that. It's not haven't really talked to too many people as far as what led up to that.
Yeah,
but I do know that you know that's what happened. Committed suicide, gunshot wound to the head, and no one has said, you know, it was personal problems or just frustrated with the way things were.
Yeah.
At work, that's still the whole mysterious thing.
Yeah. And
it's kind of one of those. It's a sad story because you know you'll always be wondering, well, what really led up to that.
Right. I mean, in my view, I mean, unimaginable stress.
Right.
In so many directions. I mean, were there any other? Do you know if Indiana had any other black faculty at all in this period of time?
Well, he was the first black faculty member. I don't know. Well, I do take it back. David Baker was there. He was one of his close friends. He was in the jazz area. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I would have interviewed him, but he passed a couple of years ago from what James Latimer was telling me. He would have been the next person to interview because they were good friends. But James Latimer delivered the eulogy at the memorial service on campus. And, you know, like I said, I'm supposed to talk to John DeFoya because he was one of his more recent students now. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is there's a plaque in honor of him because one of the rehearsal rooms at Indiana University is named in his honor, and there's a plaque on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, as was said, unless you actually talk to his students or just inquire about the history of the program, it's just not readily available. And no one is really just presenting any information on it. You hear about George Gaber and Wilbur England and John DeFoya, of course, and all the other successes. But unless you really dig deep, no one would know about Richard Johnson.
Yeah. You don't even know if he just couldn't even get auditions. I'm sure he couldn't.
Right.
He couldn't be the performer he was. Like,
right.
He must have been because.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, and particularly back then, they're not doing any blind audition. That's a newer thing, and particularly
right.
in the orchestra circuit.
Right.
But
he traveled with the Indiana University orchestras because it was known that when students could not cover parts, especially dealing with those operas, he would be called in and sometimes called in on the spot to play in. That's what James Latimer was telling me. He did extensive travel with the Indiana University Orchestra, but again, because of his color, he did not, you know, that was the difference. Whereas George Gaber may have come in with a lot of professional experiences with orchestras.
Right.
Johnson had just come up as a student there.
Yeah.
And because of his training, he really got their program off the ground and running.
Do you know of any, I mean, we've kind of hit upon some of the more usual ways that a person of color in the 50s is going to get blackballed and, mm-hmm. and, you know, passed over. Was there anything that was kind of, that so far has been really surprising as to a way that he also struggled that was, we just don't know?
Not necessarily. Just the whole thing in itself of being isolated and pushed to the back and then passed over for promotion.
Yeah.
When one person receives full professor and you only are given, you're only taken to the rank of associate professor.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's just obvious. People don't like to talk about race and
sure.
they don't like to talk about, it's like the elephant in the room. But it is what it is. There's no way around it.
Sure.
And obviously, if he was not, from what Jim Renia said, he was telling me he was an unusual hire versus just the regular process. And we know, you know, you have your search committees and so forth and so on. He was just hired on. The dean at that time just wanted him to come on and start the program. He was given that charge, and that's what James Latimer said. He was given the charge to develop courses that are still taught to this day, and charged with doing percussion ensemble. And of course, Paul Price had started the ensemble over at University of Illinois, and they had traveled over there. Mm-hmm. Also visited Roy Knapp in Chicago.
Yeah.
And so he had all this experience and knew just the foresight to know what it takes to develop a program. But like I said, unfortunately, someone was brought in over him to take the program just because he had more of that quote unquote professional experience.
Right.
And all of the years, no one knew that an African-American percussion professor was there. Mm-hmm. Johnny Lane auditioned for him at the program and met him. I want to say Van Tony Free, my predecessor at Alabama State, auditioned for him.
Yeah.
And some other people that I know of color who went there and auditioned for Richard Johnson. But the fascinating thing is, to be able to get the information now, because otherwise, like I say, he's a hidden figure.
Yeah.
And I'm grateful that the archives has kept this information all this time to be released. And, you know, you want people to know your story.
Particularly in a PWI.
Right.
When, I mean, not really having colleagues. I mean, just that part, you know, you think about it yourself. You're just like...
Sure.
I have these people that I already, that I'm either friends with, you know, that can relate to my experience.
Right.
And go ahead.
I'm sorry. I just thought about something when you said that. It was often told that he thought he was being monitored by the FBI or whatever, because his students were telling me he just always, he was just very careful and very observant. And sometimes he would think the phone was being bugged. So he kind of, in a way, they were telling me he may have seemed paranoid at some times.
Sure.
But he just knew he was being monitored and watched. Yeah. And just to live under that stress and that pressure. Mm-hmm. And the unfortunate thing about it, Pete, is that, you know, quiet as it's kept, if you go to most of the predominantly white institutions now, you don't see too many people of color.
Yeah.
In the music departments. You know, when I was a student at Ole Miss, Mr. Burkhead was on the African American in the music department.
He and I talked about it at length when he was on the show. Yeah.
And George Dorr, who's from Africa, from Ghana, was hired my second year through the New College in the music department to teach. But I remember when he came and interviewed, and I told him, I really hope you get the job. I enjoyed his presentation.
Yeah.
But one thing I can say about Mr. Burkhead, he has never compromised.
Yeah.
He has never been one to succumb to the pressure.
Right.
And one thing he instilled in me as a teacher to be who you are, to live, you know, be proud of your heritage. Mm-hmm. And to let your light shine. And the thing that inspired me with Richard Johnson, I'm just putting myself in that, is to see what he did to accomplish. Because I've experienced that, being passed over for certain jobs or wanting to serve on certain committees because of my color.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't often like to talk about it, but it's real.
Yeah.
And it's something I hope that, you know, as time goes on, we can continue to have dialogues and conversations and discuss ways to move forward and remedy that. But, you know, like I said, it's a sad story.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, have you gotten in contact with family members or anyone related to him?
I have not. The people I've interviewed, James Latimer and Jim Rainier, said they knew of family, but because of so many years passing from when they were there, actually there,
they're still trying to, you know, reach out and contact them. And as I'm finalizing, pulling all this information together in a readable form to submit to PAS as well as some other media publications for, you know, publishing, I'm still waiting to hear back from them on that regard, you know, about family members, because like I said, I feel if you're going to do something, I feel like you should do it right. And that you honor those who came before you.
Right.
And I just feel like, you know, if I'm going to attempt to do this, I need to really give just due and just credit where it, you know, where it's deserved. The Office of Affirmative Action at Indiana University announced the availability of the Johnson Rome Graduate Assistantship, and it was named in honor of him and Dr. Francis Dodson Rome, who was who's the first director of affirmative action at Indiana University. And just to give you some in-depth timeline, he was a percussion instructor from 1951 to 1958, assistant professor of music from 1958 to 1968, and associate professor from 1968 until the time of his death in 1983. But as I was saying, he never received the rank of full professor, even with being there all that time.
I was thrilled to give you the chance to hear all of that again if you'd missed it the first time. And congratulations to both Teddy and Joe for their hard work in putting all of that together. We will have new episodes for you next week. This week's rave, and it is a new rave, is the 2001 graphic novel Persepolis by Marjane Satrapi. Now, this is not a new piece of literature, but I finally got around to reading it, and it is amazing. I was never someone who grew up reading comic books or graphic novels. I really wasn't even that aware of them until about 15 years ago, to be honest. But by that time, I got to hear about The Watchmen by Alan Moore. And I bought it, and I read it, and it blew my mind. I can still remember getting to one of the major reveals that occurs near the end of that book and saying out loud, "No! No!" Just like that. That's how blown away I was. So I've returned here and there to graphic novels over the years and find them to be a pretty amazing genre of fiction and, in this case, nonfiction that tells incredible stories. Persepolis is the story of the author's first 20-plus years or so of her life, most of it under the iron fist of the Ayatollah Khomeini in the first years of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. It details the struggles, the fun, the difficulties, the outlets for amusement, and everything else that went on during those years. It's an amazing look inside a place that is frequently thought of as 100% hostile to the West and particularly to the United States, but under the surface, shares as much common ground with the United States as any other country in the region. It is in turns funny, difficult, insane, brilliant, warm, pleasing, and infuriating. If you haven't caught it yet, read the complete Persepolis. You'll be glad you did. And that's our show. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and leave a comment and a rating. You can always find all episodes and all of the show notes for the episodes on the homepage at petezambito.com/Pete's Percussion Podcast, the episodes. You can also find the show on SoundCloud, Stitcher, and wherever else you get your podcasts. If you're on Facebook, like the page Pete's Percussion Podcast. You can contact me there on Instagram and Twitter at Pete Zambito or by email at petesperkpod@gmail.com, and I will catch you next time. Until then.